Hi again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva coming to you from a far too prototypical Vancouver winter day, 7 degrees and very wet. I have the pleasure today of speaking with Andrew Lacroix, a colleague who's an assistant professor in the higher education team at Vrije Universiteit in Amsterdam. She and her colleague have a paper coming out in the March 2017 edition of Medical Education called The Swamplands of Reflection, a Conversation Analysis of Group Reflection Sessions. And before I go any further, I should also acknowledge that, Anne, I think you are the first person in all the podcasts that I've tried to record who has gone to the lengths of hiring a babysitter in order to enable this to happen. So I definitely appreciate you going above and beyond the call of duty here, and I hope we can get through this without her being impacted too dramatically.
No problem. I have all the faith that it'll all be fine.
That's great. Your paper, The Swamplands of Reflection, the title is obviously an allusion to Donald Schoen's work, but many of our listeners won't know what that concept refers to, or obviously won't have any sense yet of how it led to the work that you've done. So maybe we'll start by just asking you to explain why that was such a central concept in the project that you dreamed up.
Yes. Well, the metaphor appealed to us because we have a saying in Dutch when people are working in the field that they have their feet in the mud. I don't know if you have the same in English.
Sure.
And the swamplands appeal to that idea. So we saw the swamplands as the area where medical educators are actually teaching. They're in the class, they're doing the work. And we translated the opposite of the swamplands or the high ground. And in the high ground, the way we've interpreted it to reflection is that people are thinking a lot about definitions and intended outcomes of reflection. So it is more the higher level thinking about a concept rather than practically working with it. And what we found is that a lot of work in medical education research has been done in the high ground. So there's a lot of papers talking about what reflection is and theoretical ideas, and often they result in models like circles, pyramids, squares, parallelograms with the process of reflection, and also the intended outcomes of reflection and how you could measure it. And we felt that even though that might contribute something to a way of thinking about reflection, it doesn't actually help a person who is facilitating a reflection session in real life, who is down in the swamplands and might need tools on how to facilitate such a session. And actually, we feel that the real reflection that happens, especially when you do it in a group, is in the interaction itself. So we felt there was a niche there to be studied, that we felt that, yeah, the reality of reflection hadn't been studied enough, we thought. So we thought we'd start with these family doctors in training who have their group reflection sessions.
And so what is a group reflection session in your context? These are students who come together with a facilitator to talk about anything that they've encountered?
Yeah.
How are they prompted?
In the Netherlands, most family doctor programs, these are already people that have their basic medical degree, but they're studying to become family doctors. Mm-hmm. So they work 4 days a week in a family practice, and then 1 day a week they come back to their training program. And they start every day for 2 hours with something called exchange of experience. And that basically means there is a psychology tutor and a GP tutor. So there's a medical professional and a psychological professional and a group of somewhere around 12 to 14, I think it was, students. Mm-hmm. And it's called exchange of experience. And there is surprisingly little written on paper about what the session should be. So what basically the group is told this session is to learn from each other's experiences and to reflect. And that's when they start talking. And what we wanted to know is, what do they do when you just let them talk about that?
And so it sounds like they're quite deliberately instructed in a way that doesn't force them into any particular, you know, ivory tower, potentially, definition of reflection. This really is just an open conversation.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I have studied education as well. And for me, when I started on this project, I thought, well, hang on, where's the learning outcomes? How do we know if we've done it right? Can someone fail this? And I wanted lots more security. I was a bit surprised because you find some safety in guidelines and in checklists. Mm-hmm. And they weren't there. It was quite free. And one of the things that I've learned also in working with Mario on this data is that actually when you don't give people a specific structure, they create one. The group finds a way of doing exchange of experiences. So they haven't been told how it's done, but they create a way that they do it. And obviously the tutors have a role in that as well, which would be very interested to study in the future, to see what their role is exactly. But we've studied what happens in a group, what do they actually do? And we found that actually it isn't that messy. There is a bit of structure. They do all seem to go through certain phases in all of the conversations that we've recorded, which is what we call in the article the messy order of things. So it seems to be just free-flowing conversation and nobody's been told what to do. And when you actually study it, you try to find the building blocks of these group conversations, you find some order.
Right. I want to ask you to elaborate on that a little bit, but just before I do, we'll ask you to share some of the details of those recordings you just alluded to. I know you performed conversation analysis. This was a matter of recording a number of these group interactions, and then what does it mean to perform conversation analysis on that?
Right. Well, conversation analysis is, like I already said, studies the way conversations run, and we basically try to see if there's any patterns, if there's any logic to the way it happens. Well, one of the very famous first examples of conversation analysis is the analysis of telephone conversations. And what these famous CA people found is that there's a lot of structure in the beginnings and endings of telephone conversations. And you can actually predict, which is dangerous to say because you enter a positivist paradigm, but there's actually been studies where CA has predicted success in seeing certain patterns and the way a conversation can unfold. And what we try to do, especially in this paper, is look at what we call the overall structural organization of a conversation. The idea behind that is that a conversation has certain, well, you can almost call them chapters. Mm-hmm. And in a GP consultation, this has been studied as well. And I think you'll probably find that when you hear about these chapters, they make sense to you, because most humans that function well in society know about these things, because you know how to function socially, but you're sometimes very unaware of these rules. So one of the things, for example, at the end of a telephone conversation, you probably don't just say, yeah, mom is fine, bye, see you later, and hang up. There is a ritual to ending a conversation, and it often starts with something like, okay, a little bit of a silence.
Right.
Which then can be that's often a word to say, I am going to end the conversation. Is there anything more you want to say? If the other person answers with, yeah, okay, you kind of know that's the end of the conversation and it's fine. There's nothing more to be said. Now, we do these things every day, all the time, when we're interacting with our partners at home, with people in shops. I mean, we've all been to buy shoes, and at a certain point when you're there at the checkout, the person selling you the shoes is going to offer you product. Mm-hmm. We know it's going to happen, and we know that there's going to be a moment they're going to announce it. And we all recognize these building blocks of certain social interactions. What we wanted to do is to find what are the building blocks or the chapters in one of those group reflection sessions. Is there any order to things? Is there any predictability in what's going to happen in a group?
Yeah, and that phrase, the messy order of things that you used, is very appealing in that intuitively it does seem to capture so much of what we see in so many different domains, where there seems to be infinite complexity, there are patterns and norms, as many people have pointed out. What were the patterns and norms that you found most interesting and compelling in this particular context?
Well, I think what I found very interesting is that in our article, we make a comparison to the ALACT model, which is one of the reflection cycles that's based on experiential learning by Kolb, which obviously is a cognitive model that we started off saying that that's not what we wanted. We wanted to start with the real data. But if you look at what we found, you can see parallels with those models. But where the ALACT model says that at a certain point, the teacher should ask so-and-so to move to the next phase, we actually found it isn't necessarily an interaction between the teacher and the person that is told their story, but each of the phases in sharing a case with the group is actually shared by the whole group. And there seems to be a constant negotiation between everyone in the group what the topic should be and how long the group needs to talk about it. So it's much more of a group effort than I would have thought to start with. And that also means that sometimes there's a history in the group. So if somebody says, I'd like to share a story about a patient, I had to tell them that I thought they might have cancer and they'd have to go to the hospital. I'm just making an example up here.
Right.
They might have said that and then cried. Well, in the group, the whole reason for sharing, which is normally a whole chapter in the interaction, that was the reason for sharing, someone crying. The conversation then continues in a way where we can see signs that people know why this story is being shared, even though it's not been said. So sometimes a building block, like the reason for sharing, is just someone crying. And sometimes it's a very elaborate story about what somebody wants to learn and what she wants from the group. So I think the variation in the way that these building blocks take shape has been very interesting. And the fact that it's almost always far more of a group effort than an individual effort.
And were you able to hear things in these conversations that might indicate people were failing to connect with one another in some way? And when that occurs, is it often because people have different assumptions in terms of what the structure of the conversation be anticipated?
Yes. In the paper, we give an example where one of the tutors is trying to extract the reason for sharing. So why do you want to say this? And what is the thing we need to learn from this? And actually, the person who's telling the story is saying, no, that's not what I want to know. So there, I used the word before, there is negotiation. I think we want to focus in our next study on what the tutor's role in it is, because at the moment we've looked at the whole group and the tutor.
Right.
But we especially want to focus on how the tutor can influence this. But sometimes there's disagreement. But the person who has told their story has some sort of power, because it's their story. So the person who's telling the story has some sort of power because they have the knowledge about the story. So they are in a position where they seem to always have the possibility to interrupt and say, no, that wasn't the case, or no, that's not what I mean. So there is definitely also some sort of interesting hierarchy happening in the group, where possibly the person telling the story is hierarchically even higher than the tutors that are there to guide the session. But yes, people, sometimes they don't agree, and I think those moments are very, very interesting and worthy of more discussion, because at the moment we've looked at the phases that are similar in all the 80 hours of conversation that we've seen.
Right.
But to look at the differences is definitely also a very good idea for the future.
Well, and so let me move towards wrapping up without saying okay, by asking about similarly some of those implications then. As you mentioned early on in this conversation, that much of the research on reflection has focused on the higher ground, and by getting into these swampy lowlands, you might get better insight into what's actually happening that could be conveyed to tutors or others to help facilitate these conversations moving forward. Does that then bring it back up to the higher ground, or how do you use a study like this to try to have that impact that you're describing?
Yes. Well, one of the things that especially Mario, the first author of the paper, has done a lot of, he's had a lot of data sessions with the tutors that facilitate these reflection sessions. He anonymized the data and he said, well, this has been said in a group, how would you respond? So he used the actual data from the research to hold trainings and to facilitate discussions about what professionals want to do in reflection sessions. It's called the Conversation Analytical Roleplay Method, and it's been developed by Liz Stokoe, who's in Loughborough, Professor Elizabeth Stokoe. And it's a brilliant way to use data from the swamplands, actual recordings of conversation, to inform or create discussions about higher ground topics, like what should reflection be, which I think is a very promising way to have an evidence-based training method for professionals.
That sounds great, and I'll direct our listeners to your paper to learn some more, because I am conscious of the fact that it's 8:30 in your time and I need to let you get back to the swamplands of parenting.
Yeah. The final thing that I do think is interesting, as Mario and I are both linguists, well, he's a philosopher as well, and I'm an educationalist as well, but in our hearts we're both linguists, and we feel that everything is talk in education and everything is language. You write things down, you talk to each other. When you look at the profession of a teacher at a medical school, it's talk all day long. And I think in research, it's worthwhile to turn the camera to the classroom and to study more of what is actually being said. And I think we can draw a lot of lessons from it and at least draw a lot of conclusions about what's happening to make the discussions about medical education more worthwhile.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. That's great encouragement, and I think this paper provides a very nice model for people if they want to see how those sorts of ideas can play out in the practice of doing research like this. So to remind people of where they'll find it, it's in the March 2017 issue of Medical Education, and the title is The Swamplands of Reflection, A Conversation Analysis of Group Reflection Sessions. Thank you very much, Anne. I appreciate your time and your insight, and hope that your five-month-old is happy to get you back.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Take care.